This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
It's him or me, that's what he said. But I can't choose between a vegan and a pothead. So I chose you because you're sweet. And you give me lots of loving and you eat meat. And that's how you became my only man of the hour. You never lie, and you don't cheat, and you don't have any baggage tied to your four feet. Do I deserve to be the one who will feed you breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and take you to the park at dawn? Will you really be my only man of the hour? I know you'll never bring me flowers, but flowers, well, they will only die. And though we'll never take a shower together, I know you never argue, you don't even talk, and I like the way you let me lead you when we go outside and walk. Will you really be my only man of the hour? My only man of the hour.
You're listening to the Electric Sheep Film Show on Resonance 104.4 FM and DAB in London. I'm Electric Sheep Assistant Editor Alex Fitch, and the track you've just heard was Man of the Hour by Norah Jones. Although the song is addressed to a canine, presumably not the protagonist of The Hills Have Eyes 2, the song's theme of human consumption is introducing us to the theme of today's show, which is to say the dangers of cannibalism and eating vegetables. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Sasha Louis Vukovic about his debut film, the Canadian period drama Flora, which depicts an expedition by 1920s botanists into uncharted territory, only to find out that their new environment is completely toxic to animals and humans alike. They've run out of food, and it's a 5-mile hike to the nearest drop-off point. However, before that, our guest presenter, Tom Hunter, the host and curator of the Arthur C. Clarke Awards for Science Fiction Literature, is interviewing novelist and screenwriter Mike Carey about his acclaimed British zombie drama, The Girl with All the Gifts, and also its recently published print prequel, The Boy on the Bridge.
Good evening, my name is Tom Hunter. I am the director of the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Science Fiction Literature, so books rather than film. Mike is a shortlistee for the prize a couple of years ago with this very book. You're in there, aren't you? I think I saw you got shot in the head.
I'm the second guy who dies at the fence. It's a high point in my life today.
What was it like just being there on set, being shot in the head as a hungry, and seeing all of the words from page to film just coming to that one moment? Presumably you weren't there for very long. They just shot you and you were back in the canteen by midday.
It was 3 days. We were there for 3 days. I think Dave Gibbons sort of encapsulated this. I met him in San Diego just before the Watchmen movie came out. And I said, what's it like? And he said, it's like someone stuck a camera in my ear and filmed me inside of my head. It was just so weird and so wonderful, sort of walking around in this world that I'd had a part in making up.
And where was that actually being filmed? This is in the base.
Yeah.
So you're on the fence. You're shot in the face, I think.
Yeah. That's the only bit that we didn't film in the Midlands. Most of it was filmed in and around Birmingham, Dudley, Cannock Chase, Stoke-on-Trent. That bit, the bit where the base falls, the whole of the exterior of the base is a disused USAF base in Oxfordshire, Upper Heyford, and we have history. We'd been to Upper Heyford a couple of times in the 80s, back when cruise missiles were sighted there. It was one of the RAF bases that had been given to the US military to house cruise missiles. So we used to lie down in front of the fence and then get carried away by the police. We were in CND in the 80s, and we finally got to push the fence down. It only took 30 years.
Were you having a little bit of a revenge on the area?
It felt like that.
So I believe it's true that this whole project, novel, movie, actually just started very simply as a short story in a collection. Is that right?
It did, yeah. And it was a short story that I'd been invited by Charlene Harris and Tony Kellner to supply a story for one of their themed anthologies. They used to do this every year, and it was a very cool thing. They would give you a theme, and the theme was always something really banal, everyday, ordinary, like it might be home improvements or family holidays. And then the brief is, write a really messed up story, a dark horror story or fantasy story based around that theme. And the year that I said I would do it, the theme was school days. And I didn't come up with any decent ideas. I sat there for a few months coming up with a lot of bad riffs on Harry Potter. And then I woke up one morning. I was in Norway for the Raptors convention in a hotel room that had very, very bad heating. So I was cowering in bed, and I just had this idea. This idea popped up in my mind of a little girl in a schoolroom writing an essay, and the essay is what I want to be when I grow up. Mm-hmm. But she's a zombie. So, you know, she doesn't know that, but we do. We know that growing up is not an option for her. And that was the seed of what became the story. I wrote the story in 4 days, sent it in, and then I kind of couldn't put it down. I couldn't put the character down. I couldn't put the world down. So I kept on sort of coming back to it.
And again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were supposed to be writing something else for your novel, because you've written several books for Orbit. They were kind of urban fantasy style, and then this one's out as M.R. Carey rather than Mike Carey.
Well, at this point, I wasn't either Mike Carey or M.R. Carey. I was Adam Blake. what publishers do, if you're not selling particularly well, but they quite like the work that you're doing, they'll basically fling pseudonyms at you and genres. They'll say, you know, write in this genre, and you know, we'll see if you can pick up a market. So I'd written the Caster novels, and the Caster novels were well received, but you know, they were doing middling business. So they said, write a Dan Brown thriller. Everybody's writing Dan Brown thrillers, and everybody's buying the damn thing. So I did two thrillers as Adam Blake, and I was contracted to write a third. Mm-hmm. And I went to my editor, Anne Clark, and said, I don't want to write that novel. I want to write this novel. And it took a lot of effort, really, to make that happen, because I'd changed agents in between times. So I was on a contract to write this book, and I had to go back to the agency, MBA, and say, could you let me out of this contract under which you would get some money so I can sign a contract where you wouldn't? Would that be okay?
I bet they were thrilled.
They were wonderful, yeah. They were ecstatic, really. But we made it work, and that was Girl With All The Gifts, which is my 10th novel, and was a game changer in a lot of ways.
It's a huge word-of-mouth success, the novel.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. No, seriously, I mean, I've had it recommended to me by so many people, and it's on my fucking shortlist. which is a good sign, I think, and apologises for the swearing.
I'm not sure how it sort of it did sort of snowball at a certain point. I think to some extent it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Orbit looked at it and they saw that it had the potential, because it I guess because of the central characters and the relationship between Melanie and Justino, they felt that people who didn't necessarily read zombie novels all the time might still get something out of this, that it had, for want of a better word, a sort of crossover potential. So they marketed the hell out of it. They sent review copies out to tons of people. They did a big print run of a proof copy, an advanced review copy, and sent that out into a lot of places, and they advertised it a lot. And I think, you know, it did well, partly as a result of those things.
So I am obviously a huge fan of the book, but we've just been watching the movie, and if there's one thing that really comes through more strongly even in the film itself is those central characters, Justino and Melanie. And it almost takes you a moment to realise that you've got phenomenally strong female characters in there, which at this time is hugely important in science fiction. I mean, it's always been important, but it's a huge part of the conversation. Let's just chat about the character of Melanie for a second. Hugely fascinating. And let's narrow down on the end of that, when she makes a decision basically to kill us all off. Thanks, Mike. But it seems like that's a hugely conflicted decision, and one that's taken her the whole film to sort of come through to. And I just wanted to get your kind of take on what she's thinking in that sort of final 15, 10 minutes of the film before we all die.
I think she's realised by that point that left to themselves, humanity 1.0 and the feral children, the post-human children, will destroy each other. That basically, probably, humans have no future, but they'll last just long enough to destroy the possibility of anything else, especially if somebody like Caldwell figures out a way to use the children to fuel a cure, you know, to find a cure. So she ends that deadlock. You know, she destroys humanity as a creative act, I think, as a way of giving the world some hope of a future. And we set it up, you know, in both the novel and in the movie, through the story of Pandora. You have the sort of referent for this, which is you let all of the horrors out of the box, but there's something else at the bottom of the box, which is hope. The hope of something better coming along afterwards. So it's we saw it throughout as a happy ending, as the only possible happy ending from those premises.
I was going to ask you whether that was a bleak or a happy ending for you, and you're quite clear then.
It's hopeful. Yeah, it's a hopeful ending.
Who agrees? Hopeful ending?
Yeah.
Yeah? Miserable, depressing, nihilistic ending? Anyone? A little bit, I think.
there is in Boy on the Bridge, although Boy on the Bridge is mostly set along.
Just about to ask you. So tell us about, for those who don't know, Boy on the Bridge is...
Boy on the Bridge is the prequel equal sequel to Girl with All the Gifts. So it starts a long time before Girl with All the Gifts, finishes a long time after. Most of it is set 10 years before. So the mobile laboratory that they find, which is named for Rosalind Franklin, the chemist who basically had a larger part than anybody else in the discovery of the structure of the DNA molecule, but didn't get the Nobel Prize for it. All of the men involved in the discovery did. So they find it abandoned in the middle of London, with no clue as to what happened to the crew. Boy on the Bridge is the story of that voyage, the voyage of the Rosalind Franklin, and how it came to be there and what happened to everyone on board. But I've cheated a fair bit. So although it's broadly speaking, it's that story, there are some glimpses at the end of what the world might become, what the world does become after Melanie, A.M.,
So that's the next thing I'm going to ask you, the AM moment. You know, your two books, people always hear trilogy in the back of their head. Are we going to kind of, plans coming, the book's coming out tomorrow or something, so you must have idea of Melanie 2.
There are no plans at the moment for a third book, but there's definitely a third story to be told, which is the story of the outbreak, the story of how Cordyceps gets out into the general population. And we always knew what that story was. You know, it was sort of, it's implicit in the novel and in the movie. But it's just possible I might go back for a third.
So you're just going backwards. From okay, lovely. Yeah. Start with a bleak ending, and then we keep going back. And we know, obviously. Oh, I wonder if it will turn out okay. But no. Let's talk about cordyceps. It's a real thing. It's a horrible thing. Don't Google it. But you don't have to Google it. Mike's just going to tell us all about this horrible thing that's actually real and could kill us.
It's actually, you can YouTube it rather than Googling it. If you just go on YouTube and type in cordyceps, the first thing you'll get is the sequence from Planet Earth, from the David Attenborough documentary, which shows an infected ant. And it shows what cordyceps does to it. It's more terrifying than pretty much anything you'll ever see in a science fiction or horror movie. So cordyceps is a fungus that the spores are very sticky. So as a little ant crawls over the forest floor, it picks up the spores on its underbelly, and then the mycelia, the fungal threads, grow up through the ant's integument into its body cavity. And once they're there, they release mycoproteins, long-chain molecules, which are perfect forgeries of the ant's own neurotransmitters. Basically, it takes the ant and drives it away. It hijacks the ant's nervous system. The ant becomes a vehicle for the fungus. The fungus tells the ant, climb, find something big and climb up it. This is in a rainforest, so the big things are trees. So it climbs up to the top of a tree, anchors itself to the midrib of a leaf on the tree, and then basically just waits while the fungus eats everything inside its body and then explodes out of it. The Attenborough footage is the sort of the sporangium, the fruiting body of the fungus growing up like a little miniature tree out of the ant's head, and then it explodes. And the spores, because it's a couple of hundred feet in the air, the spores spread for miles. So the ant becomes a vector for the fungus. My story obviously posits a mutated cordyceps that could actually attack mammals, which feels like a bit of a stretch. But if you look at parasites closely for very long, you'll never sleep another night without waking up in the sweat with the sweats. There are lots of these neuro hijackers. There are thousands of organisms in nature that can do this trick, and there's at least one that can do it to you.
So sweet dreams. Thanks for coming.
it's called Toxoplasma gondii.
You're not a happy guy.
Can I just talk about Toxoplasma?
Because Did he have it? I've got that. Yeah.
We've talked. Yeah. Anyone who's a cat owner has a chance of having it. They reckon at any one time a third of the population has it in their system, which doesn't necessarily mean that you're carrying the infection. If you are carrying the infection, so basically, it infests cats, but it gets into cats by infesting mice. So it needs a way to get from the mouse into the cat, and the way it does that is by basically making the mouse blind to risk, making the mouse make really stupid decisions, like it runs across the center of a floor instead of going around the edges. It's attracted by the smell of a cat. So basically it goes out of its way to get itself eaten, and then the bacterium gets into the cat. There's some evidence, it's controversial, but there is some evidence that human beings who have toxoplasmosis make bad decisions about, for example, the speed and distance of a moving car. So you're more likely to get run over if you have it in your system, because it's doing to you what it does to the mouse.
At the end of the day, that you've moved into Zed territory. You said zombie, not hungry earlier. Even Oops. You said it. So was there anything going through your mind about, I'm about to embark on a my next work is going to be a zombie novel, basically. Was it the science that made you think you could bring a freshness to it? Was it the character of Melanie? Or did you just... Will this genre never die?
I don't think the genre ever will die, no. I mean, Melanie came first, the character came first, but I love zombie fiction. And I think it was the right time to write a zombie novel, because genres grow in stages. They go through, they have a life cycle. And the first stage with a genre is the classic text that lay down the rules. Mm-hmm. So for the modern era, Romero writes the classic text, right? I mean, we all get to know how zombieism spreads, what it does to people, what the world looks like at the moment when the outbreak happens, and so on. And all of those classic stories are stories of the collapse of civilization, the moment when the dead rise. And then once everyone's got that clear in their heads, then you can start messing with the tropes. And you can start sort of taking it for granted. You know what the zombie apocalypse looks like. It's happening in the background, but this is the story that you're hearing now. And I was doing that at the same time as lots and lots of other people were doing it. Some years behind Shaun of the Dead, some years behind Zombieland. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely second stage zombie.
Well, yeah, because those were, you know, great movies, but parody movies, they were working through those tropes and finding them funny. But again, you know, it must have been a double challenge. We've already had the airplane of zombie films, and you're coming in with something that's very serious at the end of the day. It's got a lot to talk about humanity's place on Earth, its fragility, and in fact, its eventual replacement by something better.
And I mean, I think the great thing about monsters is that, I mean, in order to survive long enough to become a trope, in order to be revisited again and again, a monster has to tell us something about ourselves. The reason why we're attracted to monsters is because they're kind of flawed mirrors for us. And they can therefore be used as metaphors for loads of stuff about, you know, different things about the human condition. You can reinvent them and use them to say, whatever it is that's in your head to say, whatever it is that you're itching to get out there. Pardon me. I think with zombies, part of the point. Romero sort of invents the zombie horde, doesn't he? And then the crucial difference between zombies and, say, vampires is that you don't meet a zombie living a sort of classy lifestyle in a castle. Mm-hmm. Zombies sort of roam around in vast herds like animals, and they remind us of animals, the kind of humanity stripped of any dignity, stripped of any purpose, stripped of sentience. And at the same time, they're corpses, they're animated corpses, so they kind of remind us of our ignoble origins and our ignoble ends. They've got us surrounded.
And without wanting to dig in too much, we'll put you on the spot. If there was one sort of... Is there a message in the book, something that you want us to kind of understand? Is it that very... sort of fact of human nature that you were just talking about, or
no? I think it's about. I mean, is there a message? The book is about. I think it's about the limits that we impose on our own humanity. It's about othering. It's about refusing to see the humanity in other people. All of the adults around Melanie are faced with that same challenge, which is: can you see a human being here, mm-hmm. or can you not? And really, they determine their fates by whether or not they're able to pass that challenge. Justin O has an instinctive sympathy with Melanie Parks, gets there slowly and painfully by seeing what she can do, by sort of coming to trust her, mm-hmm. and to use her skills. Gallagher befriends her in the hospital. Corbell never gets there until the very ending, and it's Melanie who sort of forces her to make the accommodation. Are we alive? Are we just mimicking human behaviours, or are we alive? And when Caldwell admits, yes, okay, you actually do have some kind of agency, some kind of sentience, it kind of destroys her to admit that, because the corollary is, if you're not the monster, I'm the monster. If you're a child, I've spent the last 10 years of my life dissecting children. So I guess it's about that. And as a kind of an extension of that, it's about the way in which the social roles that we enact allow us to distance other people, allow us to treat people in an inhumane way. I mean, Christ, it's 2017, we have a conservative government. So we all know about the limits of empathy, right?
I did put you on the spot, and that's an absolutely fantastic answer. Thank you very much, especially in politics. But I want to open it up, and I will, but I've just got one more. Post-Melanie, you know, after Melanie, are you hopeful for that world?
For the world that she creates.
For the world she's created, yeah.
I think it has a chance to become something better. And I think that's part of the reason why we're so obsessed with apocalypses at the moment. Apocalypses give us hope. Because it sounds grotesque, but I think it's true. Our world is terribly messed up, and there are times when it seems to be heading only in the wrong direction. So sweeping away the old... Well, first of all, it allows you to sort of decide what was worth keeping and what wasn't. And second, it gives you a chance to have another crack at it.
Fantastic.
I just want to add on to that. Would you think also that there's a bit of a nature versus nurture element in it? Because Melanie was being schooled among people, and she behaves differently than the children you find in the wild.
Yes, very much so, which is why Justino's role is so crucial, and why that last scene is so important. that basically Justineau is there as a kind of bridge between the old and the new. She's allowing the kids to sort of, you know, she's giving them what she thinks is a value, allowing them to jump over the process of sort of learning that stuff for themselves. Yeah, yeah. The Melanie has been schooled and has been given stories, and the stories allow her to reflect upon herself and to reflect upon the world and her place in the world. Yeah, I think that's a really important point.
Can I just ask, Mike? You used to work as a teacher.
I did. Yeah.
And the teacher's the one who lives at the end.
Yeah.
I think
teachers are cool.
Where are we going?
Mr. Lally and
yes,
then.
Go on then. You should chair. It's not me.
Oh, sorry.
Congratulations, Mike. And nice to see you both here with some of the cast.
Thank you, Dave.
There's been a reference to Melanie, and she's a real find. It was her first role, I believe. But I want to talk about the person at the other age, or the end of the age spectrum. A bit of a coup to get Glenn Close.
Yes.
And that won't have Help American exposure on the film. Do you want to talk a bit about how Glenn got involved?
Basically, we had our lead producer on the film, Camille Gatin, is just an amazing person, amazing producer, amazing human being. And she just said at a certain point, we're going to go out for A-list talent. I'm going to send this to Glenn Close. I'm going to send it to Gemma Arterton, Paddy Considine. And it came together around her willpower, her courage and her sort of championing the story. I couldn't believe it when I was told that Glenn had said yes. And she said afterwards that she was only about 10 pages in. And she thought, yeah, I like this. I like this story. And it made a huge difference because once she had said yes, I started rewriting Caldwell around her. And anyone who's seen the movie and read the book will recognise that the stuff, especially at the end there, is very, very different in the movie. And that's because I was writing the part to her. And seeing her say the lines, my God. The first rushes that I saw from the film, that scene where... where Caldwell walks along the corridor to Melanie's cell, and you see her from behind, and then you see Melanie peeping out of the out through the little Judas window, and then you see Caldwell turn and stare at her, and it's like a searchlight beam has just shone in your face.
No, I mean, amazing casting. I mean, that's one of the things that makes the film so powerful.
It was a dream cast in every respect. Senya obviously. Everything sort of revolves around Senya because she's on stage for something like 103 of the 110 minutes. The other children, both the feral children and the classroom children, Gemma, Glenn and Paddy, and the supporting cast, you know, Anthony Welsh as Dylan, Gallagher, Dominic Tipper as Devani. It was perfect. It was absolutely perfect casting in every respect. I'm still waiting to wake up and discover that this is all a dream.
Would you like to pick another question while you're waiting?
Yes, sorry.
So, to dovetail a little with what you just said, I'm wondering if you can comment on the difference between writing this book and this screenplay, and then maybe the difference between writing prose and writing screenplays in general for you.
Sure. I still can't see myself as a screenwriter. I've done a lot of screenwriting now, but most of it was really, sorry about this, Nina, shit. Because I came up through comics, and I tended to write screenplays as though they were comics. And actually, although they look a little bit similar, they're functionally very, very different. In a comic, you are not just the writer. You're also the director and the cinematographer. You can specify everything. You choose camera angles, you choose transitions, you choose the page turn points. It's possible to be incredibly specific about what you want. If you've ever seen an Alan Moore script, you'll know what I mean. You can't get away with that as a writer. As a screenwriter, you really can't. You have to write in a looser, more imagistic way. You have to talk about effects rather than trying to choreograph beat by beat by beat. And it took me a very, very long time to realise that. And I think this was the first screenplay I'd ever written that was fit for purpose. It was an education, really, to me, working with Colm and Cammy. And I think that was one of the crucial things, that Colm, the director, was attached to the project before there ever was a screenplay. We did all the planning together. He said in an interview, it's great making movies when everybody is making the same movie. And in this case, we really were. We all felt like we understood the story, we owned the story, we knew exactly what the story was. There are other big differences. With a novel, you live with it, you sit in a room with it for 6 months or 9 months or a year, and nobody comes near nor by, and nobody bothers you. And if you were to die at any point in that time, it would only be your family that would know. With a movie screenplay, you're clocking in all the time. Every time you do a draft, you hand it in, and lots of people give you notes on it. When you do a step outline, you hand it in, and lots of people give you notes on it. It's meeting after meeting after meeting. It's a process that's overseen by lots of different people and mediated by lots of different people. And I think another reason why we were very lucky in this case is because all the production partners were happy with what we were doing. In the whole sort of 2.5 years that we worked on it, we only got one bum note, one bad edit note, and we ignored it.
You're not going to tell us what it is, are you?
I'd be happy to tell you what it is.
What was it?
Somebody who is no longer working for the institution for which he was working at the time, said, you stop being a coward with that ending. You know, go the whole way. Melanie should lure Parks out of Rosie by lying to him and then deliberately kill him. That's a much more ballsy ending.
Nah, he needed to go, that guy. No, I mean, I think the beauty of Melanie's character is that sort of, she's not
ruthless. She has an incredible compassion, and she's a sweet kid. She's a very idealized child. Apart from the sort of having to eat human flesh thing, she's the daughter you would love to have, right?
They didn't tell me how long we were allowed to go on for, so we're just going to keep going. If anyone's got trays, no, we'll do a couple more, I think.
Gentlemen here, and then ladies, yeah. And then.
Hi, thanks. So, I've read the book and of course seen the film, loved them both. One difference I noticed was that the actual sort of mechanism, the actual explanation as to how Melanie came to be is slightly different to the film. Is there a particular reason why that in particular was changed?
Can you explain the differences?
Yeah, the difference is in the novel, it's established that Hungries sometimes have human impulses. They're sometimes still able, for example, to feel sexual desire and to have sex. And so the second generation happened through that. Whereas in the movie, it's pregnant women who get infected and then give birth afterwards. It was because it needs a lot of pipelaying from a narrative point of view to get to that realization in the novel. You have to see a lot of vivid instances of it before Caldwell can say, that's what's happening. And we just didn't have the time in the movie to do that.
So last question, I think.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
My daughter just finished reading the book, and she wanted me to ask you, firstly, would you sign a programme for her, please?
Be very happy to.
And secondly, what's Melanie's IQ?
It's genius level, I think. She's incredibly smart. She's way, way at the end of the bell curve.
In that case, when is The Boy on the Bridge out?
The Boy on the Bridge is out this Thursday. I'm really, really happy with it. I think I wrote it as a standalone. You can read it without ever having sort of seen or read Girl with All the Gifts. And it doesn't have any of the same casting. It's a completely different set of characters. But it kind of sneaks into Melanie's world through a side door. So by the time you get to the end of the novel, you will know a lot more about the stuff that's happening in this novel. That was the idea, and I think it works.
Well, the book and the movie are both great. I'm really looking forward to that next one and whatever comes after that as well. Please, a round of applause for Mike. Fantastic piece of science fiction, cinema, and novel. Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. It's amazing to have to see you all here on that Sunday night. So thank you so much.
The terrific British zombie drama, The Girl with All the Gifts, starring Gemma Atterton, Paddy Considine and Glenn Close, is available now on DVD and Blu-ray, and the print prequel, The Boy on the Bridge, by Mike Carey, is available now from all good bookshops. You can find out more about the Arthur C. Clarke Awards for Science Fiction Literature by going to clarkaward.com, that's C-L-A-R-K-E, award.com, and you can find more information about Mike Carey's work by going to mikeandpeter.com. The Girl with All the Gifts theme of tween cannibalism and the future of mankind might give you a hint about the theme of tonight's show, which is to say human consumption and the dangers therein. Conversely, for people who like their diet to be a bit more herbivore, the second of tonight's interviews will see my Q&A with the director of a new survival horror film, Flora. And to put you in the mood for that, here's the Beach Boys with Vegetables.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables, I'm gonna chow down my vegetables, I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable. Vegetables cart off and sell my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Oh,
table vegetable. I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so
Coming up next is my interview with Sasha Louis Vukovic about his film Flora, a Canadian period drama about botanists in the 1920s exploring uncharted territory, only to find that the environment is lethal to both humans and animals, they've run out of food, and it's a 5-mile hike to civilization. The interview was recorded on stage at the Stratford Picture House in East London, so you'll have to forgive the background noise, and Sasha and I are joined by actors Teresa Marie Duran and William Aaron, plus cinematographer Eric Irvin and editor Erica Gulliver. To give you a flavour, if you'll forgive the pun, of the movie, here's an extract from the trailer.
Doesn't make much sense, does it? Building a pulp mill all the way up here, and then abandoning it.
So where's your professor?
He hasn't been here this morning.
We got in last night. There were no lamps, no welcome party, no nothing.
How many days are we from the nearest town?
Half a day's paddling, and then two by car.
Dr. Keating! Dr. Keating!
Professor!
Dr. Keating!
Professor! We need a search. We only need a search right now. The man knew what was up here.
None of us are seeing it.
None of us are seeing what?
We have to run.
So there's all sorts of potential influences that I could see in that film, sort of Edgar Rice Burroughs meets Cabin Fever. What were the sort of things that went into the idea behind this movie?
For me, it was more about, I think, just the fact that we spend a lot of our lives not looking at what's around us and not really taking into account the fact that we share the earth with the flora, that all life kind of comes and works off of itself, and works with itself. And fauna and flora are the two things on the planet, and they work with each other at all times. And I just realized that I knew very, very little about the grass that I was walking on, the trees that I was around. And the primary inspiration for me was less stylistic. It was more to do with the story of, for me, understanding more about that, and then telling a story which is about a world in which those two things do not cohabitate so well. And seeing if that would allow an audience or any artist involved with the project or anyone doing the project to take a second to look a little bit closer at plants, and also look a little bit closer at the relationship that it shares with us as humans.
Presumably, in order to get all the science right, you consulted with botanists.
Yes. I did. Early on in the writing process, I kind of went to a botanist and I told them, so I want to make a forest that has absolutely no animal life whatsoever. How could that be feasible? And then I bantered back and forth with a botanist for a long time at a university in Toronto. And she finally told me about endophytes. And one of the interesting things about these things especially is that there's a theory that says that the human race, the only reason that we survived until this point is actually it's a fluke. Because there are, in most of the grains that we eat, there are endophytic fungi. And it's a fungi that becomes innocuous when you dry out the grain. Like most mushrooms, when it's dried out, they lose their life. And because we stored our grain back in the Middle Ages and back in throughout our history, we essentially neutralized a lot of the plants that could have killed us. And we neutralized these fungi. Whereas a lot of other animals have had to develop their stomachs, or they haven't been able to evolve as quickly as fast because they essentially couldn't cook, or they couldn't store their materials. So yeah, that was a massive. It was kind of the genesis, part of the genesis of how the project started.
Your handmade canvas kind of bio suits were a fantastic design. Can you talk about the costume design you worked with?
Yes, the costume designer is from Chicago. Her name's Olivia Ball. She works at the Goodman and on a couple television shows. Goodman's a theater in Chicago. And the design for that was, it was a bunch of people coming together to make those happen. Initially, the idea of turning their camp into suits came from me. Then I have the original artist on the project is a cousin of mine who was a graphic artist, and he did concept art. And then the costume designer came in and worked a lot. And then finalization was actually with the art director, who the art director in the project is also the lead actress on the film, Teresa Madore. And she worked a lot to find props like the masks that really fit the story properly and really worked. So it was a collaboration of a lot of people, but the costume designer really worked hard to make there's a lot of sewing involved.
What was it like running through the woods wearing those suits?
Heavy. Hot. I think, I don't know if this will spoil anything for anyone, but I think the best day on set was how we were figuring out how to run through the pollen field. And the first attempt, so it's a leaf blower. A leaf blower stuffed with cornstarch. And the first attempt was for me to hold it directly in front of my face and run with it. And we figured out very soon that there was no possible way for me to breathe because the eye holes were out, so all the cake of cornstarch just completely suffocated me for real. And that was probably the most intense day on set. But we were also quite worried about the cliff jump, so we actually had to do that shot very last because we were worried, one, that we might sink with the weight of the canvas, so we actually had life preservers underneath.
Wow.
So we had to make the costumes big enough to fit life preservers underneath because of the weight of the period costumes and the weight of the masks and everything, we thought we might sink. So we did that shot. That was our very last shot. So that was also an interesting experience in the suits. I don't know, William, do you have anything to add? William played Charles, so he was in them. Oh, you weren't in them.
I was never in the series.
You were not. I'm so sorry. You didn't make it that far.
Is that your contract? Kill me off before I have to wear the suit.
Well, I only had about 3 weeks that I could actually film the project before I had to fly back to New York City. So, yeah, it just made more sense. Like, I had to, like, do all of these shots first, and then as soon as they're in the suits, I was pretty much already gone, like, back in New York City, and they're way north of Montreal and Quebec. So actually, it wasn't my contract.
How far away from civilization, for a better word, were you filming?
Eric. Eric is the cinematographer on the project. And just briefly, also Erica is the editor on the project.
What would you say, we're about an hour and a half or so north of Montreal.
Yeah.
In a very small town. And they had almost both French there. Mostly all buddies. So you speak a little bit of French, so you were mostly a translator the entire time. We were out in the wilderness. We were staying at his family's cabin, 13 of us on production. And it was a very small team. And Sasha and I would get up very early every morning, several hours before all the actors would get up, and we'd go out and set up shots in the woods. We pretty much lived out in the woods for a month and a half. So it was pretty intense. Yeah.
Were any shots unexpectedly spoiled because of an unexpected bird of prey going through the shot?
They're not birds in the shot, but mosquitoes.
Right.
And there's not supposed to be any insects or life or anything in this woods, so they actually had to do a lot of, and you can talk about who did this and stuff, but they had to do a lot of After Effects and take out all the mosquitoes and bugs flying around the shot.
Yeah.
Oh, and lots of bug spray. Like, we probably spent the most money out of anything on bug spray.
It's true. There's 110 visual effects shots in the film, and they're all just removal of mosquitoes. Very seriously. It's kind of intense.
You mentioned that you all hold up in a family cabin.
Yeah.
So was any of the kind of the horror of this movie based on childhood experiences?
No, actually. I would, right, as my father sits here.
In a good way.
Yeah. I had the most wonderful upbringing. I've kind of always been... I grew up a lot of my life in that cabin. It's more of a house, but it is out in the forest, and I think it definitely made me fall in love with the woods, and it made me want to tell stories that kind of delve into the woods. But the horror elements of it were more based on, they're definitely not in my life, they're more based on me wanting to create a drama between the plants and humans.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that someone has now made a movie warning about the terrible, terrible dangers of veganism.
Yeah. On that note, the botanist who worked on the project, when I asked her about is she a vegetarian, is she a vegan, she said no, very far from it. She's actually more wary of plants after the things she's seen, the stuff that she's worked on, than she is of any animal product. And not necessarily because for health reasons, but she just says that... plants are really, really dynamically dangerous and very interesting. All of the deaths that happen in the film, we don't go into specifics as to how each one of them happens or why they happened, but all of them are based on something that a plant can actually do to you.
Wow.
So just in general, I think it's just important to, like...
Yeah. Respect.
Respect.
Yeah. As the whole film was shot with natural light, perhaps you talked a little about the editing. Did that cause any problems, cloudy days versus sunny days?
Continuity-wise, you guys were pretty lucky as far as weather. It was a bit of an interesting project for me because these guys mostly knew each other or had a connection to each other, and I came in not knowing any of them, and after it had already been shot, and then was sort of just handed a hard drive and said, we've come out of the woods, see what you can figure out. But
No, there was a lot of challenges in the audio and then in, you know, sort of choosing, initially we were sort of choosing scenes to avoid bugs, and then it was like, you know, we're just going to need a really good visual effects team, and we'll keep the bugs in for now. But yeah, otherwise you guys have had a great time. I wasn't at the cabin, so I didn't live the in the woods experience.
Erica got to come up to, there was a week where I wanted her to see the place. And so I, the first cut that we did of the movie, we did it up at the cottage, but it was in the middle of the winter. Mm. So she saw it in a very different state of affairs. Yes. But yeah.
There's some great topographical features in a movie like that, outcrop that they would stand on for one shot. How much was the script developed around your memory of the landscape around the cabin?
That's actually, a lot of it, actually. What's interesting about the shot that you just brought up is there are two sections in the film where they were not shot around like this one area. The two sections were the mill sequence and that shot of that cliff. I didn't have a cliff around me, which was kind of grandiose and stunning enough that that I wanted to use. And so we found a cliff face that was in Sudbury, which is like 15 hours away by vehicle. And I took everybody kind of on a crazy chase across most of a province in order to go for that one shot. We all camped in a one tent, nine of us for one evening, woke up the next morning, shot everything that next morning, and then packed up and drove back. However, the rest of the film, I was really lucky in that I... all the forest locations are around where I live, around where this where the cottage is. And also there was kind of a real helpful thing in that if you were trying to make a film, or I found, I was... But I'm trying to make a film where I'm showing constantly forest locations over and over and over again. How do I eventually distinguish one from the other and make you feel like you are going on a journey and not just seeing a wash of green the whole time? So then it was really highlighting in the script, okay, waterfall, river, swampy area, pine forest, and then it deepened my knowledge of forests as well. But yeah, geography itself has kind of its own interesting... differences.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yes. Does anyone in the audience have any questions for the cast of crew?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the type of camera, lenses you used, some of those stuff? Because it's shot really good.
Thank you. Yeah, it's kind of interesting how not much equipment we had. We had a Panasonic Lumix J4. It was shot in 4K. And that camera is tiny. If nobody knows that camera, it is like really small. And then we used Rokinon lenses, 14mm, 35mm, and 85mm. And one GoPro shot underwater. The underwater shot was a GoPro inside of a mask. And we had a drone for that one, a cliff shot at the end with the train.
R.I.P. drone.
Yeah, the drone crashed right after. Actually, at the end of that shot, hit a tree and crashed into water. So that was very
in memoriam.
Yes, but we had a jib out there. Some of those lifting shots was a jib, and then a shoulder mount, and a few of the walking shots were with a small stabilizer called Blackbird.
Yeah, Eric lived kind of more of almost an intense experience than the performers had to, because that he had to essentially have a camera. The reason why we worked with a small one is because you could move very quickly with it, and we were shooting very fast, but also he lived a more intense experience in that he was running through brush with no suit cover and having to keep up with them and often not watching where he was running, and making sure that he was safe is really like a credit to his capabilities.
So no falls or concussion?
No concussions. Maybe some falls.
Jeff from the red top.
I thought the sounds really added to the atmosphere of the film as well. And you had some really nice music. I don't really know a whole lot about music, but I was just wondering if the songs that you had were contemporaneous or were they specifically for your main for the film?
It's a mixed bag. The sound, one of the, like this, kind of letting the air out of the bag on this one, cat out of the bag on this one, is that almost the entire film, all the sound was created in the studio, which is something that we realized once we finished. It was one of Erica's...
The dialogue as well.
The dialogue as well. We ADR'd the entire film. So because of the idea of there were birds, we were shooting very quickly. And so another credit to Erica is that when she received the movie, she was working with very, very rough audio and was able to piece together the entire story with that challenge. So we had a brilliant sound designer who came on board and rebuilt everything. Which is incredible. And then the composer and I, we kind of worked in two formats. We worked one, which was building the score of the piece. And then those specific points where music exists, initially in the script, I'd written some pieces which I thought fit properly. However, four of the songs are jazz, which we recorded in New York City with jazz musicians, and just recorded them in a way that makes them sound very old. But based on songs which are pre-existing from the period. And then there's one song, the one where they leave into the woods, which is Everybody Happy Now, which actually is from the period.
What was the source of the hallucinations? Was it them going mad, or was it poet?
I think it's definitely the plants that are causing it. But similarly to when Will's character gets something on his face and another character vomits, I kind of tried to give them each a different way in which a plant can attack you. And all of our narcotics and drugs are they're plants. And so without being able to have too much time to delve into each one and why it happened, and scientifically the students wouldn't understand exactly what was going on to them, it was definitely a hallucination based on pollen.
You didn't ask any of the cast to experiment with it.
No. There was no funding for that.
Or insurance.
Where do we buy the soundtrack?
At some point later this year, it'll be on iTunes. We're figuring all of this out for the first time, so.
Any non-Apple platforms,
anything? Possibly. Again, we are figuring it out.
You know the Apple bits have cyanide in them. If anyone has any more questions, are you on Facebook and Twitter and that kind of thing?
We are. If you just look up Flora the Movie on Google, you'll see a bunch of links to us. And we'll be doing things throughout the year.
Cool. Well, it was a fantastic film, and thank you for bringing it to Sci-Fi.
Thank you.
The excellent sci-fi survival horror film Flora, directed by Sasha Louis Vukovic, is currently doing the rounds of various film festivals. To find out more about the film and where it will be screening next, please go to www.florathemovie.com, where you can find clips of the film and more information about the making of this excellent Canadian drama. Both of tonight's Q&As were recorded at Sci-Fi London, London's international science fiction and fantastic film festival, and you can find out more about Sci-Fi London by going to sci-fi-london.com, where you can find trailers for all of the films they showed this year, as well as a variety of shorts, podcasts, and much more. If you're a fan of science fiction, the Barbican has a major new exhibition opening at the beginning of June called Into the Unknown, A Journey Through Science Fiction, which includes art, design, film, and literature, from the 19th century cabinet of curiosities to the vastness of space. The exhibition includes examples of the work of Jules Verne, Ray Harryhausen, Margaret Atwood, Jack Kirby, and many more, with new art by Isaac Julian, Larissa Sansor, and Conrad Shawcross, and an installation from the creators of Black Mirror. The Barbican will also have weekend screenings of Little Scene and sci-fi classics, so please go to www.barbican.org.uk to find out more about the forthcoming exhibition and film programme, which opens on the 3rd of June and runs until the beginning of September. If your tastes are a bit more down to earth, then Sheffield's award-winning documentary festival, DocFest, opens on the 9th of June and runs until the 14th. With new films by Damon Davis and Sabah Jordan, Reid Andoni, Dar and Kasulu Musia, as well as digital work from Theo Anthony, Hannah Jones and many others, DocFest is a terrific celebration of the latest non-fiction works to hit the large and small screens, and you can find out more by going to Chef, that's S-H-E-F-F, docfest.com. Before that, in London, there's the last of the current season of Miskatonic lectures taking place at the Horse Hospital near Russell Square Tube in London. From 7 p.m. on the 18th of May, this week's lecture is all about Haitian voodoo and atavism, tracing how the zombie in fiction shapes xenophobic and neo-colonial imaginings of Haiti as a country mired in superstition and incapable of enlightened self-governance. The lecture is given by John Cussons, an artist, writer and researcher based in London, who has been working with the Ghetto Biennale in Port-au-Prince since 2009. You can find out more information about the Miskatonic Lectures and all Electric Sheep podcasts by going to electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events. The Electric Sheep Film Show was presented, edited and recorded by Alex Fitch and is a Panel Borders production. We'll be back on the third Wednesday in June, and to play out, here's C.W. Stone King with Zombie. Thanks for listening.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
I got a brand new dance here for you. This one is called The Zombie. But when you hear that zombie rocking slow till the break of dawn in the Congo, ain't gonna let you rest till the morning light. Gonna raise some sand in the dead of night. My mama hear them mumbling low. They go shuffling, shuffling across the floor. Can you hear the little children cry? Watch out! Zombies are terrible to fight. This old new sensation. Another stone cold hit coming up out the radio. It goes so slow, it don't never quit. Man, you can't fight it, don't even try. Left and right days gone in drag step time. This old repetition make them lose their mind. So chillin', direct your feet right away all along. That all infectious beat. Come on, everyone you know out in the street, we gon' see if you can't sing along. But when you hear that zombie rockin' slow till the break of dawn in the Congo, ain't gon' let you rest till the morning light. Gon' raise some sand in the dead of night. My mama hear them mumbling low. Go shuffling, shuffling across the floor. Can you hear the little children cry? Watch out! Zombies are terrible to fight. I've grown so afraid of the man in the street. With a finger on the pulse, look dead on his feet. Close my eyes, but why can I not rest? Cause the fear of death that do not die unsettled me where I lie. That's why I bring them my best old slow-footed jump. Here rolling with the things in the night go bump. I won't rid my head of all that nasty niggling jump. But when you hear this zombie rocking slow till the break of dawn in the Congo, ain't gonna let you. morning light. Don't raise some sand to the night.
The lands
my mama hear them mumbling low. They go shuffling, shuffling across the floor.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.